Welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This week's discussion is brought to you by CN Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. CN Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator in protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at www.cnshoreline.com. And of course, Res. Res is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at www.res.us. All right, I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite a while. Mayor Holly Rashein and I met about 20 years ago when I was a staffer in the Senate. And over the years, she has made quite a name for herself in the environmental sphere. As the title says, she is the current mayor of Monroe County. She's also served as a four-term member of the Florida House of Representatives, including a stint as the chair of the influential Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee. She has served and continues to serve on a wide array of philanthropic boards and has been recognized over and over for the positive impact she has made on her community and the state of Florida. So without further ado, Mayor Rashein, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Brett. And this is something I've been looking forward to as a big fan of your podcast.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. All right. So let's get right to your parents, because I am curious how people end up moving to Alaska. And my dad and brother were both stationed there in the military. My dad was in the Navy. My brother was in the Army. So that was the Aleutian Islands and Fairbanks. I think it's Fort Greeley. I don't know if it's still named that or not. But I doubt either one of them ever really considered staying. And so as a Florida guy, especially your father, you know, because he's from Florida, right? Lake County?
He is. He was born in Eustis, Florida, outside of Umatilla, Florida, if you really want to get into the nitty gritty. And my family actually hails from Paisley, Florida.
Oh.
My great-grandfather was born and raised there, and he was into farming. And he, a little known fact actually, Brett, is that he served in the legislature in the 1940s.
Really?
And he was also a county commissioner in Lake County. And people are always like, oh, it's in your blood. He was a wonderful man. He died rather young when my dad was young. So I never got the opportunity or the honor of meeting him. But that was always kind of in my background, but not something that I necessarily aspired to. And so my grandpa, his son-in-law, my tutu, my grandma's dad, my grandpa wanted to move to Alaska. His brother-in-law had already moved up there with one of his older sisters, and he was an aspiring bush pilot.
Okay.
And lived in the boonies in Alaska. And so my grandpa just thought that was the neatest thing. My poppy, we'll call him. We'll talk about him probably a little later. And he picked up my dad, my grandma, and my uncle and moved them to Alaska in 1963. This was the year before the great earthquake in 1964. And my dad was essentially raised up there, you know, moved up in kindergarten, first grade. And my grandpa did get into aviation. He kind of dabbled in it, kind of a wannabe bush pilot, but actually ended up being a union cable splicer for the phone company for decades and actually retired from the phone company.
Wow.
And my mom's family, if we want to move to that end of things,
yeah,
her family came from Michigan, and she came from a majority immigrant family. My grandpa came from Poland, and my grandma's side came from Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they wanted to move to Alaska because it was a new state. It was still had the last frontier feel, and you could get a job, you could raise a family, and there were a lot of opportunities because it was just starting to come out of the ground, and they settled in Anchorage.
So was it kind of like a 49ers thing in the like 19th century, except now that what Alaska became a state, what, 59, I think it was?
Yes. No gold, though. No gold, just jobs.
No gold, just
jobs. So they had to work hard, and they did. And my mom is one of five girls, God bless my grandpa. And they, you know, worked hard. My entire family did. My dad ended up getting into to aviation.
And all just in the Anchorage area. You mentioned a little farther north at some point.
Yes. And so that's where they settled. But, okay, you know, Alaska is a big state. And we had a motorhome. Yeah, we had, I know you mentioned the Aleutian Islands. Wow, talk about the boonies. Mm-hmm. Jeez. And then Fairbanks, you know, was the actual quote unquote other city, if you will, besides Juneau, the capital. But yeah, Fairbanks is quite beautiful. Yeah, my family got settled and actually many of them are still there.
Oh, nice. At what age did they end up there? Both of them were born in Michigan and Florida, right?
Yes. And so my dad ended up there when he was 6 years old. My mom ended up in Alaska when she was 12 years old. Mm. And my parents actually, for the first time, met in junior high.
Really?
It was a small town. You can imagine there's not a lot of kids in these certain age groups. Mm. And they actually got in trouble riding my dad's dirt bike because they weren't supposed to take it off road, and my mom did and wrecked it, had to pay my father back in the day.
Wow.
And use her hard-earned money that she had. I think she was babysitting and working somewhere else in junior high because you could do that back then. And that's when they first met, but then there was a follow-up meeting to that.
So it wasn't love at first sight, or was it, hey, there's that guy over there and I'm sort of, I see him, but it's not happening yet?
No. And I think they were too young and they actually went to different junior highs. Oh, okay. If you can imagine at that time, there was more than one.
Wow.
Again, it was a budding city. It was really exploding because Anchorage was kind of the hub where everybody, you know, had their main, I guess their main home, but then they worked in the bush or they worked on the slope, you know, with the oil pipeline beginning to go into the ground and all that getting started. And they actually eventually met and started dating again in high school. And this is, I don't want my people to think my dad's a, you know, creep or creepy, but he saw my mom get off the school bus. And he was driving and did kind of a wheelie, did a donut real quick and turned around. And my grandma was picking up my mom that day off the bus and he followed her home. And that's kind of where their romance began. And they actually got married November of 1975, which is the November after they both graduated high school. Mm. I actually came along 5 years later. And they've been married ever since, and they will be married 50 years in 2025, if you can believe it.
Wow. And do they still live there, or where do they live?
Yeah, so they split their time. Mm-hmm. And going back to my great-grandfather, Hartley Hendrick Hethcox, he built a home in Umatilla, Florida in the 40s when my grandma was a little girl, and it's still there. And obviously he had already passed, and my great-grandma was really aging, and my family really wanted her to stay in her home as long as possible. Mm. And so in order to help that effort out, my parents purchased the home and stay there for 6 months out of the year when it's really cold and really awful and really dark in Alaska. So they're there pretty much October through April. And then they spend the rest of their time in Anchorage. And my dad is in aviation. He actually kind of followed the family trajectory and got his A&P and is an aircraft mechanic.
Oh,
He still owns T&B Aircraft Repair. Has for 40 years, if you can believe it. But now he doesn't really wrench a lot. He mostly does owner assist, a lot of inspections. You know, he's getting up there. Love you, Dad. And he doesn't need to be doing the hardcore stuff anymore. His knees are starting to go a little bit, and he's extremely talented. And my mom, actually, she worked in the aviation world and did a lot of charter flight organization, and she was a teacher's aide for a long, long time. She was a bank teller when I was born. She's really a jack of all trade and extremely talented as well.
Was it because, you know, their husband and wife that she eventually, was she involved in the business or different?
Not exactly in my dad's business. Okay. She helped out with, you know, with the books and things like that.
Okay.
But they did not technically work together. They had their own professional lives, and I think that they really preferred it.
Yeah, safer that way.
That way, and they it's worked out ever since. And something neat to highlight is my dad, he's a doer. He's always tinkering with something, building something. And so when he's in Umatilla, he actually works at the Ace Hardware there. Mm. And he helps out all the little ladies and folks that come in and they need help. And obviously he's a mechanic. He fixes flying machines.
Right.
And so he can help them pick out whatever part they need for their sink.
Right, right. That sounds awesome. All right. So we've got a baseline here for your parents and grandparents, even a little deeper than that. But let's go to Little Holly Merrill in Anchorage, Alaska. And I guess I'm just curious, like, what were you like as a young kid?
Oh, bless my parents. I kept them on their toes. I was extremely energetic. I think that, sure. Obviously. And I was really into the outdoors. How can you live in Alaska and not be in the outdoors?
Right.
And love them. And I did. I actually used to play in the snow, which now moving to Florida, I can't imagine. I used to be out there for hours playing and building forts and things like that. But during the summer, I really liked to be outside, whether we were fishing, hiking, going camping with my grandpas. I really was into biology. And would, you know, one, for example, you know, there was a moose that died behind my house and there was, the skeleton or whatever. And I thought, you know, I want to go and, you know, I pulled all the teeth out and just weird little things like that. I would grow butterflies in our shed, collect rocks and thought that I wanted to be a geologist at one point and really loved, you know, marine biology and things like that. Not obviously when I was little, but my mom recognized that I had a lot of energy and my second love in life was dance. Hmm. My grandma and my mom took me to see the Nutcracker when I was 3 years old. And I thought, man, I want to do that. And so she put me in dance when I was 3 years old. And I actually still dance when I have the opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of, you know, bifurcated my time between playing outside, going to dance, and I was always on a bicycle. As soon as I learned how to ride and I was allowed to be out with friends, always on a bicycle.
Yeah, yeah, I hear that. Let me ask, how many people, I guess maybe wrong question is now, it's how many people were in Anchorage when you were a little kid?
Well, now it's a city of about, it's about the size of Tallahassee. What is it, 350,000?
Yeah.
So in Anchorage, it's probably around 250,000. But back then, probably half of that.
Okay.
And then, you know, as people caught on to the opportunities to excel financially and professionally, and, you know, the university grew and the pipeline really took off, our city grew. And it is quite different. I didn't think about it then being different, but now being in Florida for so many years, it was different and it was very neat. And it helped, you know, shape the person I am today.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing is like, it's hard for, you know, for someone like me, I grew up in, you know, Strawberry Fields and Orange Groves and Eastern Hillsborough County. And so thinking about, in my mind, it's like, I see this, you know, this wild adventure of growing up in a place like Alaska. It sounds like there's a little bit of that. We would moose teeth and that sort of
it
thing.
It is. And speaking of moose, I have to share this story. You know, people always ask me, do you see moose all the time? Hmm. Remember, they don't roam far past where they were born. I don't know, what is it, 5 mile radius or whatever. And I actually got chased home in second grade. You know, we used to have to walk to school. Or ride our bikes.
Right.
You can't really ride your bike when it's wintertime. And yeah, got a little too close to one time. And he got up and kind of chased my friend and I a little bit. And we were always to hide behind a tree, hide behind a snowbank, hide behind a car. We had to do that until he kind of went off on his merry way. And then we could, you know, we could keep going home. But it was really neat. And it's something, you know, now as I get older, I wouldn't say that I took it for granted. But now I have the opportunity to compare and living in the beautiful Sunshine State and then growing up in the last frontier, I'm really blessed.
Yeah, I guess we'll get to your son a little bit because there's some of that too. Like where you live now is also, when it comes to places to grow up, like a pretty adventurous place, you know, with surrounded by water. And so I'll let you get to that in a little bit. But I guess, you know, on that vein, like, were you a good student? I mean, there's the adventure side, but
yes,
how was the school side?
Yes, and I loved school. Oh, I loved it so much. And I think my school career and when I really just, you know, got into academics and loving to go to school. I'm an only child, by the way. I thought I'd throw out there. And so I depended on school and my dance classes to, you know, for my friend groups, for my peers.
Sure.
And I had wonderful cousins too. So I got the family side of things. And I actually, I have to brag about myself because Drake, yeah. my son, just asked me this the other day. He's like, Mom, like, what kind of grades did you get? And I said, actually, I was a straight A student from third grade to eighth grade.
Wow.
I loved it. I dedicated myself to school. I loved most of my teachers for the, you know, for the most part. I mean, some of them were tough, but they recognized in me, I think, that my dedication, and I knew that the better grades you had, the better off you were going to be. And again, going back to, I loved school. High school, however, I discovered boys and I got busy. I danced more. I got a job. And so I did not have straight A's through my high school career. I also figured out that I wasn't going to be a biologist because you had to do too much chemistry and math was not my subject, my favorite subject or the one that I was blessed to be. Brighton, quite the opposite, actually. But I did end up graduating with honors, thank goodness.
Well, that's good. Let's pause there at that job of yours. What were you doing?
So my first job was at Pizza Time. It was a local pizzeria. They had a couple locations in Anchorage. Okay. And I started off answering the phones, taking people's orders. I suggest folks that order from Domino's be really sweet to the people on the phone because they're fielding a lot of calls and people that want what they want. And so I worked the phones for, gosh, I don't know, probably a whole summer and then moved up. Actually got to start making pizzas. My best friend that danced with me as well, we worked at Pizza Time together. So it was a wonderful job that I actually held just about almost through my senior year.
Okay.
I also taught dance too, though.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you were busy back then as well.
Yeah.
Was there something at some point you transitioned from chemistry takes math to what do I actually want to be, you know, when I grow up? Did you have an idea at that point or were you just kind of winging it?
I did have some ideas. I certainly had, you know, aspirations and I knew that I did want to leave Alaska. So we had vacationed in Florida. I think I was a newborn baby the first time we came to, you know, my parents' first baby down and show off.
Sure.
To the family. And we just, you know, subsequently vacationed in Florida every year that I can remember. And I wasn't exactly sure until probably my freshman, sophomore year in high school that I did want to get into government. Of course, every girl wants to be a ballerina. Come on. But I was in Alaska. I didn't have the exposure to the lessons or to the schools or to all that goes with being a dancer. Right. And quite frankly, I don't know that I quite had the talent. I had the drive, but it's like being an NFL football player. You got to make the call.
Right.
And so I made the call and government was my second, my very close second, something that I took interest in, something that I knew was not going anywhere and something that I knew I could get a job in. What that looked like back then, I had no idea. Right. And my inspiration was my grandpa, was my poppy. From a very young age, he would preach to me about the importance of being watchful of your government, of being part of your government if you could, and paying attention. And from I can remember hiking around in the woods with him and he'd go off on this tangent about something that was going on in our world or in our country. And it was very important to me. And then he really planted the seed. And I knew that, you know, I had some sort of calling, obviously knowing my background with my great grandfather back in the day, but I knew there was opportunity there.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess you answered part of the question because I had this all teed up, which is, I actually Googled like how far away is Anchorage from Tallahassee? And it's like a little over 4,500 miles right now. You want to make it a cool 5,000 from Anchorage. And so why in the end Florida State was because the capital was here?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. And so for a girl from Alaska, I really didn't have those deep allegiances, if you will, to UF or to FSU. And I was like, oh, UF, FSU, you know, Gators versus Seminoles. I'm like, okay, both sound groovy.
Right.
But FSU is located in the capital. And I thought, you know, I put the puzzle together in my head. I want to get my degree in political science. I surely can find a job or learn the process. I didn't even know what the process was then. I didn't know that word, a phrase. And that was my ultimate choice. And I applied, thank goodness, and got in, thank goodness. So here I am.
Wow. All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADs protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADs have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right. Their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, let's get back to the conversation. Now, I should say when you and I met, it's probably 2002, 2003, somewhere in there. But you were going to be a future four-term member of the Florida House, and you were working with a mutual friend, now Senator Ana Maria Rodriguez.
She was actually my boss.
Was she? Oh.
She was my supervisor, yes. Oh, my goodness. If you can imagine.
I can imagine, actually. Did you two talk about, like, was there a point when you were doing that that you're like, I'm going to be, I can do this, I can be state representative, I can be a state senator?
Believe it or not, we didn't. No, that was actually not part of our friendship. That wasn't really part of our discussions. Why? Because we had to deal with the electeds all the time.
Right.
And we would plan events, we would take part in campaigns, we would take clients around to the representatives and the senators. And then obviously we did a lot of work at the local level. So that wasn't something that was on our hearts or our minds. I mean, maybe subconsciously. No, that wasn't my first go-to.
How long did the two of you work together?
We 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, 2 years, actually. And Bob Levy, I have to say his name one more time.
Yeah.
I do miss him. And he was close with my first boss, which I'm sure we'll talk about briefly.
Yeah. I mean, let's get to it. So you go, I mean, is that the transition?
That was the transition. Okay. Yes. So Bob had a good relationship with then another late great Representative Ken Sorensen, Republican. And he represented District 120, which was the Florida Keys and Southern Miami-Dade County and Kendall back in the day. That's when they could redistrict
right.
in different ways. We'll leave it at that. And he needed an aide. And I had actually just gone through FSU's academic dive program, scuba program, where we did 2 hours of lecture and 2 hours of pool work. Yeah, that was like my senior year. And I took wine tasting too. But
nice.
And I was newly certified. I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I had just put a down payment on a Jeep with my graduation money, loaded everything in a U-Haul trailer, and drove down to the Keys after Ken hired me.
Wow.
Never been to the Keys. Not once had I stepped foot in that beautiful community.
Wow.
I remember it was dark when I drove down the 18-mile stretch.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, I woke up and I walked around and I looked at where I had landed. And funny little inside pointer is I actually lived in Ken's garage for 3 months while I figured out where I was and where I needed to live and what I had stumbled upon, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And it's been magical ever since.
Magical, I would say, probably in geography, but unless you're a masochist, I can't imagine someone wanting to be a legislative aide, at least not for long. But it's definitely a learning experience.
It is. And I had the opportunity to work for two different representatives. Mm-hmm. And my second boss was Representative Ron Saunders, who everybody knows had served previously and was a former appropriations chairman under Speaker T.K. Weatherall. May he rest in peace. And so I got to learn both sides of the aisle, which is something that I don't know that a lot of folks get to in our world.
Doubtful.
But I loved aide life. I really got to drill down on what was important to the district. I got to learn Southern Miami-Dade County, very different from urban Miami-Dade County.
Yes.
And I got to and I'm still trying to figure out what makes the beautiful Florida Keys tick. And I got to volunteer on boards. I got to be out in the community on behalf of my bosses all the time. And I loved it. And I, you know, obviously working for Bob, I had learned the inside of the Capitol and that part of the process. But that's not all.
Right.
Constituent service is technically why people are, what I feel, you know, people should really run for office. And that's to help people with government, because it can be, they can get themselves into a quagmire and find themselves in a really hopeless situation. And so actually my first part of my job was constituent service. And I interfaced with state agencies or, you know, even with the local governments and said, hey, you need to help this guy or gal iron out this issue. And if you can't, then maybe I need to take this to my boss who we can change state statute to fix this. Because if they're having this issue, somebody else across the state has got to be having the same thing. So it was something that I still find delightful and something that I'm very proud of.
Was that something you felt when you were with Bob? He has very specific clients. You have very specific issues. Sometimes they stretch a little bit. I mean, he had a wide array. But was it at that point you felt like you were really learning government, at least in Florida and in that district?
Yes. And I think Florida government is so wonderful. Yeah. It still astounds me and it still excites me. And I'm still learning to this day. And I encourage people, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more, you know, to start that. And obviously you don't get into public service for the money.
Right.
But you get into it for the experience and you get into it for your community and representing one of the most unique areas in the United States of America, if not the planet.
Right.
What's not to love?
Yeah. And I mean, but you still, you have to want to serve. And if you don't, like, you're miserable.
Find another job.
Right.
Find something that that turns your crank, that makes you tick.
Exactly. I mean, otherwise, you're going to be miserable. Your boss is going to be miserable. You know, in your sense,
your community is going to be miserable.
Right.
You know, don't do it. Find something else to do.
When was the point in your mind where you said, I can, not only can I do this, but I want to do this here?
Yeah, it kind of happened pretty quickly. So Ron, Representative Saunders, was going to run for the state Senate. And that opened up his seat. He still had, another term left. And I was kind of watching the playing field, if you will, the cycle take shape of who wanted to run to replace him. And I was like, you know, I just had that feeling in my gut, like, I don't know if that's like the best idea. And and I had just had a baby, by the way. Drake had been born in January of 2012. And people, you know, I started to just sprinkle the thought of running for Ron's seat with my friends and my family and my husband. And and people are like, okay, I mean, it's you, Holly. If anybody can do it, you can. But, you know, like, let's think this out. And I just had that, you know, that fire in my belly that just, I kept kind of stoking, and some other folks stoked it a little bit. And eventually I filed and I had a primary and I had a general.
Wow.
And I like to say that a lot of folks, you know, say shake hands and kiss babies. I just brought my own cute baby with me. So,
well, I mean, let me ask you that question, since we're talking about, I mean, largely the Florida Keys. But certainly, you know, as you said, extends into South Miami-Dade. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and I don't know that district very well, or, you know, other than I like going there, is it seems like the party side of the politics doesn't weigh as much as something else. Is that true? And if it is, what is that something else?
Yes, and I think the community and the character and the uniqueness and the sort of isolation, and I should make a point and do my comparison between the Keys and Alaska at some point, just to nudge you on that one,
because
it makes sense when I lay it out. But yeah, party is I mean, you have to pick a party, right? You can't run as an independent and try, you know, think that you're going to get elected. Maybe you can in other places, but in our community, you have to pick a side, and it's very purple. And I always came from the perspective that as long as we're taking care of the Keys, as long as we're helping Southern Miami-Dade County, which is often overshadowed by urban Miami-Dade County, we're doing the right thing. And working across the aisle was very easy for me. I'm a relatively moderate person myself, libertarian. And I think that we focus more on the issues, and they can be sometimes more intense or, you know, just different
right.
than other areas. You know, in Southern Miami-Dade, you've got the Redland. It's farming on the edge of the Everglades with Florida Bay as at the southernmost point. And then you've got, not the southernmost point, but south of that, south of the Glades. And then you've got Biscayne Bay on the east, which flows down into the Atlantic and into the island chain. I mean, it is, like I said, the most unique, most wonderful, most diverse, most sensitive areas, if you ask me, in our state.
Yeah, it'd be hard. It'd be hard to argue that. And and so let me ask you about governing then. So you win your primary, you win a race, and now you gotta do the thing.
Ugh, yes.
So what was your philosophy going into it? Was it something that you kind of gleaned from folks that you work with, like Saunders and Sorensen, or is it something that was more in your DNA?
I think it was more in my DNA and just my personal experience with being an aide and working for Bob and trying to apply those principles that, you know, I could get stuff done. And I thought, you know, taking no for an answer is not going to work for the Keys. We need a loud voice. Again, we're unique. And then obviously taking into account the needs of Southern Miami-Dade County, which were virtually opposite of the Keys, night and day, black and white.
Wow.
And balancing that was incredibly important. And I think speaking of balance is something that I still strive to do this day, right? You're not going to get everything you want. And you're working with two sides of an issue and you negotiate, you bring things to the table. And then if everybody walks away and feels like they didn't get anything, you totally won. And that's where I really tried to fall. And, you know, I love to pour love on the Keys, on Southern Miami-Dade County, but often we pour government on them. And so trying to find that sweet spot, and something that, you know, maybe we'll talk about in a few minutes is, you know, we're an area of critical state concern in the Keys. That's a whole nother podcast. Let's talk about what that means.
Well, I mean, let's do that. You mentioned the distinction between Alaska and the Keys. So let's start then. We'll get to the governing part, although I know it's interwoven. And so feel free to throw that in there. But talk a bit about those distinctions, the special nature of those two places, but in quite different ways.
Yes.
Right?
And then again, just the blessings that I have from being, you know, living in one place and being from the other. People always find it so wild that I've lived at the, you know, northernmost point and now at the southernmost point of the continental United States. And quite frankly, I feel right at home in the Keys. Geography is extreme. The climate is extreme. Fishing is important. Yeah. Tourism is important. Veterans and the military is important. The people are fiercely loyal and a little kooky. Mm-hmm. And so when I moved down and really got the, you know, into the swing of things in the Keys, I'm like, okay, it doesn't snow here, but it's very similar to where I grew up. And I think that's how I've really been able to embrace the fabulous Florida Keys.
So instead of moose, it's six-toed cats and chickens
yes,
in the streets?
Chickens, iguanas.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, the iguanas, yes.
All right, let's talk about the legislative time. You end up serving as a chair of two very important committees during your time in the legislature. So let's take them one at a time. And the first one, because we're still people will hear this in a week, but we are still very much in the legislative session. We are at budget time, which means money. And you are the chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee that deals with things that I care about the most, which are, you know, environment and natural resources. So let's talk about that. Does your time as the Appropriations Chair help you in your current job in terms of understanding and context of the things you're dealing with? Because you have the scope of all of the issues for the entire state then, but I want you to talk about that and then kind of pull it back into Monroe County, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And what an incredible opportunity that was for me. And I'm grateful to Speaker Oliva, who said, you know what, that girl understands this. Go ahead. And we're going to put her in that spot. And my gosh, during budget time, it was nonstop, as you know, as a you know person who runs clients and things like that. Every project has merit. Every project that is submitted through the process has merit to the person who is submitting it or to the community that they represent. And so it was difficult not to say yes to everything.
Right.
But there's, you know, there's not enough money for all the needs, much less the wants. And so there was an incredible amount of pressure. And of course, I was chair of the Appropriations Committee when we had to hear all the budget projects one by one. And
oh, that's
where I honed in on my skills to run meetings. That is something that has served me well. And now that I get to run the meetings on behalf of the county, it has been helpful. But, you know, passing the budget and the appropriations process is the only thing that is actually constitutionally required by the
right.
legislature. They could literally just come up, leave everybody alone or, you know, not, and pass a budget and go home. And so knowing that you were part of that and you know, obviously it was a very top-down, top-heavy sort of leadership style,
sure.
but I don't know that that's any different than the past or the present.
Sure.
We've got a lot of mouths to feed, and the water silo, it was and still continues to be hot ticket item.
Yeah, I think it's the number of individual projects seem to be enormous when you look at the water side of things. Maybe not total dollar wise, but certainly in the volume of mm-hmm. those needs. Let me ask you, and it may or may not be fair, but can you give a little bit of that peek behind the curtain? I think maybe to contextualize it, maybe think about it in terms of how do you approach it now? Monroe County has needs now. You have legislative budget requests. You as the mayor and you know and your fellows on the commission have to try to pitch for it. Is the work, tell me about the work you did, and then is there a secret combination or is it different than that?
I wish there was a secret formula that I could write down on a piece of paper and slip it to you right now, but there's not. And I think a lot of it was managing expectations and meeting with folks. You know, we'd have mayors or councilmen or city managers, administrators, obviously lobbyists, come and explain their projects. And it was so wonderful for my personal edification to hear about the diversity issues that we have in our state with regard to water.
Sure.
I thought I knew a little bit. I think I've learned a lot from that process. And, you know, having to explain just what I said earlier, there's not enough to cover the needs, much less the wants. And so what we were tasked with as appropriations subcommittee chairs is to prioritize those, comb through all those applications, obviously doing that with staff. Scarlett was my budget director back then. She might have retired. I don't know. Is she still?
She's still around helping.
She is? Oh, good. Good, good. What a wonderful lady. And she really held my hand and helped me because it was a massive effort. And, you know, do communities have matching funds? Do the residents have skin in the game?
Mm-hmm.
Are they just asking for a handout? How important is this to the overall, you know, ecological system that surrounds their community?
Right.
Is this going to help out development project? Is it going to make it better? Is it going to make it worse? Is this having to do with agriculture mitigation? I mean, it was such a wide array. And then at the same time, managing the big asks like for the Everglades.
Yeah.
And I had my own big ask, which I'm sure you're going to ask me about.
That's where we're going, right? That's an excellent segue. So let's go right to it because you passed the Florida Keys Stewardship Act, which is enormous. I'm looking at year on year how it's grown as well in scope and in the things that it's been able to accomplish. And so talk about from you know inception to birth to where it is now, because now it belongs to you back home, right?
It does. And you know, I'm so proud. Like my heart overflows every time I hear somebody say the Florida Keys Stewardship Act. And previously to that, we had like the working waterfronts. We had the Stan Mayfield grant where, you know, the Keys would always, you know, come out fighting right out of the gate for that funding because we had so many asks and needs. And specifically, we were under a state mandate to completely sewer the entire 20-mile island chain. That's huge. Why? Because we are an area of critical state concern. We were designated one the late 70s, and then subsequently that designation changed and morphed. The state recognized how environmentally sensitive we were. The negatives, the detriments, the everything that was going on, the development and things like that in the Keys was really affecting what makes the Keys so special, and that is our water and our coral reefs.
I don't want to interrupt you while you, I know you're on that the string of talking about, but for folks that don't know, talk about some of those. Could you talk about sewering the entire Keys, sensitive areas? Can you talk about just a little bit of the why, you know, that's involved in those? What are the impacts that those things have on those places?
Yeah, so we weren't any different than many other communities across the state. We were a community of septic tanks, and that can only last so long. And the state, again, recognized through the Department of Environmental Protection, and I'm sure the South Florida Water Management District and many other organizations that have oversight over our bodies of water, were like, something is not right here. Our nearshore water quality is in the toilet, literally, really, pun intended. Our coral reef is starting to degrade. Our fishing is starting to feel the, you know, just these negatives by not being hooked up to a central sewer. And so kicking and screaming, it took 20 years, over $1 billion to completely sewer the island chain. And it's not like putting in a sewer system in Palatka, and I'm not picking on Palatka, but they have dirt. Right. You know what we have? We're a prehistoric coral reef. Like, we're having to dig through coral rock to put this stuff in and to do it right. And we weren't just tasked with regular treatment. We were tasked with advanced wastewater treatment, as we should be. I'm not complaining. This is something that needed to be done. Again, it was a massive effort. Everybody had skin in the game, whether it was the residents, the government. We got money from the feds, the state, the locals. I mean, it was all-out effort, and we are seeing the fruits of our labor. Our waters are improving. And I say, you know, some folks find it very difficult, very expensive, very labor-intensive to hook up to sewers. And I always tell them, God bless you. You know, if we can do it in the Keys, you can do it wherever you're from.
Yeah. And I think, but it's I don't know if there's another place in the state, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, like I think you'll agree. Is there another place where if the water isn't right, it's over? Like, without that water quality, why on earth would anyone go down there?
Our way of life, right, whether you live, you work, you play there, depends on the water. And our number one industry is obviously tourism. Why do you come to the Keys? You come to the Keys to go scuba diving, snorkeling, fishing, boating, bird watching. If we don't have healthy water, the birds aren't happy. They can't, you know, do their thing. And it's, you know, the fishing community really rose up and spoke loudly with regard to certain things. And obviously they still have a strong voice too, but I think that we really, really did move the needle, and things are a lot better.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation. Let me talk about another. It's kind of like on one hand, you have the huge challenge of protecting, you know, natural systems from a water quality perspective. Now, on the other hand, you have this little thing that we get in Florida called hurricanes, and you're on a tiny little series of spits of land, or coral, as you say, that's right in the alley for hurricanes. Talk about how you dealt with those issues first as a legislator. And so put on your legislator hat as how you approach what happens after a hurricane and what happens before the next one. And then we'll move to as a community and then your role with Ash Bricks. I'm curious about that as well.
Yes. And that's a wonderful topic and something that we need to do the hurricane dance. So they stay away from us this season, this upcoming season, but we are the most hurricane prone county in the United States of America. I always say that we're kind of the tail that wags the dog of Florida, but we are the tail that sticks out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
And if something's coming, it's most likely going to skirt the Keys. It's going to come over the Keys. It's going to go above the Keys. We're going to get an effect or effects. And it's our last major storm, and I actually get anxiety when I say this name out loud, was Hurricane Irma. And that was a Category 4 storm that went through the lower and middle Keys, and it devastated so much of the island chain. But we're skinny and we're long, and so the devastation that you saw in other communities was, you know, at a higher rate than we experienced in the Keys, just because we don't have that land mass. But the detrimental effects on the coral reefs, you know, the coral reef helps us out with hurricane,
sure,
keeping them at bay. But like our coral nurseries, we have a very advanced program up and down the Keys where we're, you know, planting baby coral and growing them and then outplanting them actually on the reef. And so those things like that, you know, were devastated. I lived off beef jerky and Gatorade, I think, for like 3 months, I swear. But we are resilient and we're used to it. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the conchs in Key West. And that place was open in 30 days. Governor Scott sent a message, we've got to open Florida back up. We've got to, you know, pick ourselves up and get back to business. And those folks down there got it together and they were open in 30 days post Hurricane Irma. But I was really happy that I got to sit on the Hurricane Task Force panel that really dissected the state's response to Hurricane Irma and where there were areas of improvements that needed to be made, whether it was fuel, evacuation rates, supply chain, debris removal. I mean, it's a huge process, and our community, unfortunately, just had to go through it with Hurricane Ian, Hurricane Michael, and Hurricane Idalia. And so with each passing of, you know, each storm, I think that we get better and better, and we truly are the model for how to deal with natural disasters.
Yeah, I guess it's like you either stick with the status quo and you just try to figure out how to pick up the pieces, but it does seem like we get better and better every time. You learn a little bit more and a little bit more. And so I think that's a good spot to talk about Ashbury, because there are huge people like them are certainly an enormous part of not just the reacting, but also the learning from, you know, errors, challenges, you know, things that come up, you know, because they're dealing with each one, right?
They are. And it's incredibly, you know, complex between finding, you know, again, the sweet spot between government and the private sector, because government can't do it all.
No.
You really need to empower the private sector, who has an incentive to get the work done and quite frankly wants to get the work done and has the bandwidth to get the work done and the people and all that goes into that. And like I said, you know, Florida, we really have a good formula. We really have a good plan. And like I said, unfortunately, it takes more storms to really drill down on that. Mm-hmm. But
was it your work in the legislature dealing with, you know, especially Irma, that drove you to want to work on that side, you know, of the equation in terms of Ashbury?
Well, it's certainly exciting work. And I experienced Ashbury during Hurricane Irma and really was exposed to the emergency response apparatus. It's a large scale rollout, whether you're talking about DOT, DEP, the National Guard, you know, that's right out of the gate after the passing of the storm. But then it's everything that happens after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our founder, Randy Perkins, started the business after Hurricane Andrew.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we just celebrated our 30-year anniversary, and he came down. He was in Miami and actually made it south to Homestead and noticed that it was just utter chaos. No one had a plan. There was no debris management plan. People didn't even know what that was. Mm-hmm. The government, whether you were talking about the state, the county, the city of Homestead, no one knew what to do. That's how grave and terrible the devastation was. And he really was the godfather of what, you know, the industry calls pre-position, and getting in during blue sky times, working with your clients, working with your local governments. And me, from an elected's perspective, it was natural. It was a natural fit for me. We come in when a community is on its knees. Mm-hmm. And we are, you know, an all-encompassing government services firm, right? And specifically, obviously, our core mission is debris removal. But emergencies and hurricanes and tornadoes or whatever it might be aren't just debris. Like, right. Communities need supplies. You might need somewhere to house your people. You need meals. You need comfort stations. That's kind of the new word that came about after the pandemic, when we did some work with special needs kids, because you can't just give a special needs kid a vaccine in a normal setting. And so we, you know, have really bobbed and weaved as an industry, as a company. And, you know, it's a family company. It's a very big company, but it's a small family company. And Brittany is our CEO. She's the Brit of Ashbrit. And working under her has been an incredible eye-opening experience and an adventure. You know, she grew up in hurricanes. She grew up in tornadoes. She grew up in the aftermath of all of these disasters that have faced communities over the years. And she has, you know, just become a wonderful person to watch in this process. So yeah, I thought it was a natural fit. And being the, you know, I specifically focus on Florida. I love Florida, as you know, especially love the Florida Keys, but I love all of Florida. And being able to use my experience and now subsequently being elected myself, when I can go into a conference room with a county administrator or a city manager and be with electeds who are my peers, and I can say, hey, brother, sister, you know, I've been there with you. I understand the confusion you might be feeling. I understand that your constituents are yelling at you because their streets aren't cleaned up. Let me level with you and let me explain the process and how we're going to help you as quickly as possible.
That's awesome. And so let's move to, we've talked about your mayorship. We've talked about Ashbrit, but that's not all I'm looking at here. And I spent a little time looking at your resume, and it reminds me a lot of my wife, Karen. And as far as I know, it seems like she has like 47 or 47,000 jobs and serves on all these community boards and things like that. And so my question for you is, how many jobs do you actually have? Because I got three, I think, I see from the resume, then about a dozen-ish community service organizations. So help me understand what your day-to-day life looks like.
Yeah, so that's a wonderful question, one that I really can't answer. It's different every single day. But yes, I do have three jobs. I love them all. They're all very different. Obviously, the commissioner job is my public service job, which I cherish and quite honored to have. And then my, what I call my big girl job, my private sector job. You know, I'd worked in government my whole life. And switching over and pivoting to the private sector was a huge move for me and very nerve-wracking. And obviously, it was during the pandemic. And there was at one point where I was like, oh, man, you know, the state of Florida was like a warm blanket. I don't know that I made the right choice, but I did. And I powered through it and have really enjoyed my time with Ashbrit. And then balancing, you know, my elected job with that, it augments it, actually, I mentioned earlier. And then I have a side hustle. I'm the Upper Keys market advisor for First State Bank. It is the last local bank in the fabulous Florida Keys. And who wouldn't want to bank local?
Right.
And so I...
What is that, though? You mentioned the job. It's like, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah. So I encourage people to utilize their local resources. We've had banks change names, the other banks that are from out of town, probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 times. We have out-of-towners come in, take over our banks. They you know, businesses and residents alike have to go through this whole rigmarole of changing accounts and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you know how much I love the Keys.
Yeah.
And keeping things as local as possible and strengthening, you know, the very foundation. You know, why not the bank? Why not the local bank? And so I was approached actually right before Hurricane Irma to bring that on. And, you know, when I forgot to mention this, when I was an aide, I was also a server. You've got to have multiple jobs to make it in the Keys.
Very, very interesting. That's, I mean, but it's also cool. Like I said, like my wife does a whole bunch of jobs and I don't know how y'all do it. You know, I have a job and then, you know, I press record. You know, on the box here.
It's a good one, though.
Yeah.
It's a good job. Cool. And this is a good, this is, I love the podcast, but back to my community service boards. Love those. Pretty diverse grouping of causes that I dedicate myself to. And it's, I think that that provides me and other folks who serve on these boards as an outlet to kind of take a deep breath and apply your skills to helping out these nonprofits that don't necessarily have that within their core, you know, organization. And obviously people lean on me a lot when it comes to government and trying to help them navigate that process, and happy to do letters of support for grants and things like that. But the Monroe County Education Foundation, that's like our Take Stock in Children arm.
Okay.
Love working for that organization. We really kick butt in the Keys with regard to Take Stock. I volunteer for the Healthy Start Coalition. It is actually the really... It's really the only maternal and infant health organization in the Keys. That's something that we struggle with down there. And another one of my favorites, going back to my dancing passion, is I'm the county's representative on the Florida Keys Council on the Arts. Hmm. So I love that. And then one that I'm new to and one that has really lit my fire is the Early Learning Coalition.
Okay.
And that is a support arm for parents who are working that need resources to put their kids in preschool. I mean, it's basically a school readiness program. And I've recently learned, and something that has fired me up, is many of our single parents, and one single mom that I've been mentoring for years, she's a server, and she makes too much money to qualify for these programs. So it's things like that. Mm. They don't necessarily keep me up at night, but I certainly want to keep serving on this board to see if we can't fix that. But that's just a little bit of a clue into my days.
Yeah, I mean, let me find a way to meld that in then. So, and those are some really important things that you're working on. But you're the mayor of Monroe County, which includes all the Florida Keys, mm-hmm. and so that basically means that you're the mayor of Vacationville. You know, Florida, actually the United States, really. How did that come about? Was it just, hey, you know, I know I can serve as an elected official. I know this community. I want to help. Why did you do it again? And then how is that part going so far? And how does that fit in with the other service that you like to do?
Yeah, so I think it all fits together somehow, and we all come together and melt in the Keys. And I actually love it, Brett. And we rotate between the five of us. Mm. And so I'll be the mayor for this whole year.
Right.
I'm super excited about it. I get to run the meetings.
Nice.
I get to be the spokesperson for the community. That's something I'm not necessarily shy about. And I think the most fun thing that I got to do was I was deputized as a deputy clerk for a whole day on Valentine's Day. And I got to marry people.
Really?
In front of the courthouse. And we had two couples that wanted to renew their vows. And then we had two newlywed couples that got married. And it was incredible. We had balloons and cake and confetti.
Wow.
And so that was one of the most fun things. But I do run out of hours in the day, and I do struggle with time management, and it's something that I always strive to be better at. I make lists. I prioritize things. I prioritize my son. He's 12. He's in Little League right now. He's obviously my most important job, actually. I talked about the other three, but the first one is the most important. That's being Drake's mom. And then I make sure that I you know, as I've gotten into my 40s, self-care is a pretty important thing. Mm. I love to go to yoga. I like to work out, you know, get my nails done, things like that. And so making sure all of that weaves together into this beautiful, crazy thread of my life, that's what keeps me busy. That's what keeps me going. And I wake up every morning ready to hit it again.
Wow. So tell me about, we talked about some of those natural resources for the Keys, and you, I think it may tie in some to those philanthropic endeavors of yours, and maybe, and almost certainly as a commissioner and mayor. Talk about the Keys, talk about Monroe County as a community itself. Like, for people who have never been there, other than the water, how would you describe it?
Wow, that's a loaded question.
I know.
And one that I'm happy to explore. The Upper Keys are different than the Middle Keys. And then you have the Lower Keys, and then you have Key West. But I think something unites us, and that's a tremendous commitment to our way of life. And it is a little slower. We don't have the malls. We have limited restaurants, but a lot of them are local. And I think there's a sense of pride that and unity. We're very unified. We don't always agree. That would be weird if we did. And I think everybody recognizes that sometimes why people go to Alaska. They want a different experience.
Right.
They get not really off the grid, but they want to get away. They just need a change of scenery. And I think you see a lot of that in the Keys, but it is our natural resources that really do unite us. And with the passage of the Florida Keys Stewardship Act, you know, that calls for $20 million a year for really important water projects, whether it's, you know, stormwater, canal restoration, which ultimately goes to improve our coral reefs, our fisheries. I mean, all of that, you know, is really the water connects us.
Mm-hmm. How do you look at that now in those terms where you've passed this really cool legislation and now you've attached not just more and more dollars, you know, each time, and the $20 million, you know, to boot? What are the challenges that you're looking at now from that natural resource, you know, natural system perspective? What are the things you're still worried about there?
Yeah, so we have a terrible bacterial disease that's eating the reef, literally from the inside out. It's the stony coral tissue loss disease. And that, you know, you can debate all day long where it came from, but I have an idea. And it's attacking, you know, we have what, you know, 3% of the reef left, and we've got an army of scientists, whether it's Moat Marine or the Coral Restoration Foundation or the numerous other organizations that work hard on this. You know, that's something that can affect the future of the Keys. If we don't have that, if we don't have the fisheries that depend on the reef, we're not going to have a Keys. Mm-hmm. I think it's important with regard to our critical, you know, our area of critical state concern status, our development. The state controls our development. We don't look like Miami Beach for a reason. There's a reason why the state is our watchdog, and we have a rate of growth ordinance that we follow very closely. Again, going back to my earlier comments, there is no other place on the planet like the Florida Keys, and I think people recognize that. And it took me just a hot minute to recognize that. And I wouldn't want to live anywhere else in the world. I love the Keys. I know people who live there love the Keys. And you kind of make it or break it there. You either get it or you don't. And if you can learn that way of life, and it's not always, you know, Island Time or Margaritaville.
Sure.
It is often. And you can make it what you want it to be. But it can be challenging. But it's the challenge that I think makes it worth it.
Okay. I guess I'm skipping to a part that I do with everyone, but I want to drill it on that one issue first, and then we'll expand it to statewide or universally or however you want to approach it. You bring up the 3% of the coral reefs. Folks are working on it. I mean, how are you feeling? Are you feeling optimistic here?
I feel cautiously optimistic, to be cliche, quite frankly. I know that there are a lot of eyes on the situation, a lot of science going into fixing this problem, but we need an army of scuba divers. We need an army of citizen scientists that can come in, learn real quick how to, you know, take a piece of epoxy, take the coral, don't touch it, stick it on the reef. Like, we need to be doing this. We're doing it in the hundreds of thousands. We need to be doing it in the millions.
Wow.
And I think there is a will. So, I mean, there's a way, and there certainly is a will. And that does sometimes keep me up at night, especially when you hear the numbers. And, you know, this last summer was the hottest summer on record. We had to pull the coral out of the water put it in pools, let it sit there until the water calmed down, and then subsequently go back and replant it. I mean, this is the things that are going on down in the Keys. I know Miami is experiencing the same thing. And we also are working on alternatives like artificial reefs and things like that, because I think that might be the wave of the future. But that doesn't mean that we don't, you know, we still need to fix the original, the OG.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, let me just throw that in there. Then when you talk about artificial reefs, are they getting better, or is it still just, hey, let's sink a ship, you know, out in the water?
They're
and
getting
see how it goes.
Way better. They're getting way better, Brett. Thank goodness. The ships, I think, and nothing against the Spiegel or, you know, all the different boats that are down in the abyss, if you will. I've dove them and they're neat. But I think that, like anything, technology has improved and we're going to be seeing different structures that I think are more, you know, beneficial for the environment. I think that they will set the pace. It'll be quicker and we'll see, you know, some improvements.
All right. Well, then let's take a look at yourself then. And I guess specifically as your time as a legislator, because you're in the middle of it now. And so what you do is what you do every day. When you look back at your 8 years, is there something that you felt like you walked away? It's like, I wasn't able to quite pull the trigger on it. You got the stewardship act done. Was there anything else there that you're like, I would have done that a little differently, or I would have set this up differently at the time?
I think the one thing, and this still kind of continues to irk me, is that we never gave the attention to Miami-Dade County that we should have. Mm. It is a behemoth of a community. It's got so many issues with regard to water and upgrades and things like that. And I commend my counterpart up there, Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. She's like a water warrior, she calls herself, and she is. But she's one person. And I think that, you know, Broward's kind of got their act together. Palm Beach is working hard. But Miami, it's right on the edge of the Everglades. It's our neighbor to the north. And I think that more attention, and maybe with Speaker Danny Perez coming in, I know he's Mr. Miami, you know, maybe we'll see that. But I just remember that being left on the table. And, you know, they've got an incredible tax base. They have an incredible population. People are still pouring into that place. And what does that mean? You know, are they going to suck our drinking water away? Mm-hmm. Are we going to have to be doing RO in the Keys, like, because Miami-Dade has sucked all the water? And so I think finding a balance and being a good partner and a good neighbor with Miami-Dade, I think, is something that I still want to commit myself to.
I like it. All right, now broaden the scope on the are you optimistic or pessimistic to broader Florida or beyond. Are you optimistic overall about the future of the environment?
I am an eternal optimist, and I have a 12-year-old, so I have no choice.
Right.
Now, I'm fearful for maybe not his kids, but maybe his kids' kids, in terms of having drinking water, in terms of being able to feed themselves, in terms of the ocean heating up, in terms of ocean acidification. Yeah, I'm going there. Just one second, you know, with regard to fisheries and things like that. So, and from a long-term perspective, I am nervous. With our efforts and everything that we have turned to and are continuing to work on, I feel better. I don't think that we're the sinking ship as Florida or the nation that we used to be. And I think, you know, the whole conversation about working with our international counterparts and things like that has to happen, because there's only so much the state of Florida can do.
Right.
And there's only so much that, the United States of America can do. But at the end of the day, it doesn't always keep me up at night, but I am optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing, is like the question is, what keeps you up at night? And almost no one, I mean, answers it, you know, in this way where it's like, hey, I lose sleep over it, because most people I talk to are like yourself, where they're doers. And so my sense is that you don't stay up at night. You just, you know, get up well rested and go back at it again.
I wish I could say that's the case all the time.
Sometimes
last week there's a couple things going on in the community right now, and I just woke up instantly at like 4 a.m. thinking about Monroe County and the Keys and things that are going on. And this rarely happens to me, but it is a big deal. You know, some of the things that we are talking about right now. Mm-hmm. But that does rarely happen. But again, the Keys deserve that kind of attention.
All right. So here's one. I think it's important. I have, you know, 2 young daughters and, you know, one that's not as young, but still young compared to me. You have a young son. What would you tell young folks from Drake's age to ones that are, you know, just getting into college or in college about the approach to getting into the environmental field, into public service?
Do it. If you have one little spark, one little ember down in your belly that you're interested in government in any way, shape, or form, do it. Volunteer for a campaign. Be a legislative aide. That is something that I picked up being a member versus, you know, being an aide. I can tell when people have worked on the inside. They just get it. There's just that gleam in their eye. And we need the next generation of leaders that are focusing on the environment or education. They are. They're the ones that are going to take care of us when we're older and getting up there. And I actually make that a priority, especially with young women, young girls, like Pace Center for Girls. I love to go to their events and talk about government. I try to, you know, make it as cool as I can, because talking about government isn't always super fun, but I try to put some, you know, icing on that cake. And I say do it. You know, it's a passion of mine, so maybe that's easy for me to say, but I think that we as this current generation need to be doing maybe a little more encouraging the next generation.
I like it. You heard it, young folks. The mayor says you have to do it. So, Holly Rashine, it has been so great catching up with you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Brett, I just wanted to say thank you to you, and I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast. I haven't previously been a big podcast person, and focusing on water is even better. So thank you, and thank you to all your people.
You bet. Too kind. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. It helps. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod, and you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com with your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Sworn for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close, your water closer.